I have to admit, it was probably one of the hardest counseling sessions that I ever had to kind of go through. And that was when I was at another church. A young man, couldn't have been more than 16 years old, came to me, scheduled a thing and said, I needed to talk to you. And I said, okay. And so he showed up and we started talking. And I said, so, like, well, kind of what brings you in today? Like, what's going on? And he says, well, I'm really struggling because I think God hates me. And I went, huh, why do you think God hates you? He said, I just got diagnosed with a brain tumor, and they've given me about a year to live. So clearly, I have done something that has upset God, and he is punishing me by giving me a brain tumor, and I don't know what it is, and I'm really struggling. Now, I think most of you would kind of have an idea of how to respond to something like that, which is that God doesn't do that very frequently, where there's a one-to-one correlation between the sin we have in our life and some of the stuff that we have. Oftentimes, he just simply lets natural consequences take their course. In this particular instance, this was more of an issue of the evil and the sin that's in this world is sometimes so difficult to deal with, and the way it rears its ugly head causes us to question the goodness and the graciousness of God. But we have to answer the question, is there times that God gets angry? And are there times that God gets angry with us? And if God gets angry with us, is it justified? Do we deserve it? And these are the types of things that we believe Jeremiah is wrestling with, this concept of, I think God hates me. And God is angry. I make it a little bit lighter. I don't know why you have certain random weird things from the past that really stick into your brain, but I remember growing up and watching the incredible sitcom known as Silver Spoons. Diane's excited. She loves Silver Spoons. Ricky Schroeder. No, we're not getting into that story. Heather's like, Ricky Schroeder asked me out. Yeah, whatever. Who cares? You got someone better than Ricky Schroeder. Right? Didn't you? Why did you laugh at that? Why did you laugh? Oh, my gosh. Anyway, Silver Spoons, it's this struggle of Mr. Drummond and...
No, Mr. Drummond.
That's different. Who is the dad? Shoot. I don't remember. Someone's going to Google. Yeah, yeah. Anyway, there was a time when the character played by Ricky Schroeder was doing bad things as a kid, and his dad just didn't want to punish him. He was worried that, like, if I punish him, he's not going to be happy with me. He's going to maybe even rebel a little bit further. And all of a sudden, Ricky Schroeder is picking up on this, and it actually causes him to be upset and actually sad. And there's this big blow up in the that particular episode where the Rick Schroeder's character said, "Why don't you love me?" And he says, "What are you talking about? I really love you." He says, "You do not love me because you have never given me a punishment for things that I've done wrong." Now, I know that that never happens. Like, you know, no kid's like, "You don't love me because you don't punish me enough." But I thought it was interesting because as a kid watching that, I was like, huh, that's interesting. If God never gets angry, how much does he then love me? Now, obviously, I'm not asking and inviting the wrath of God to be poured out on me, because I don't think anyone enjoys that. But I think that the love of God sometimes has to come out in his anger. That sometimes the stuff that we're doing and the way that we're living is going to be so offensive that God's going to have to do something about it. And I think God getting angry, there's purposes, right? There's purposes for God's anger. I mean, one of the biggest purposes of God's anger is to wake us up and to help us see that maybe the things that we are doing or the path that we are on is not a good path. Another reason might be we might have built up so much ego or pride or sin in our life that we have just become almost unrecognizable as a child of God. And God has to come in a very serious way and with his anger peel back all of the garbage and the junk that's happened in our life. And it hurts. It's painful. One of the greatest examples that I know in literary works is in the book The Voyage of the Dawn Treader by C.S. Lewis. It features this kid named Eustace Clarence Scrubbs. And opening lines go, his name was Eustace Clarence Scrubbs, and he almost deserved it, having that name be his life. But Eustace ended up there doing this voyage or trying to sail to the end of the world, and they're on this boat called the Dawn Treader. And as he's going there, Eustace ends up finding some gold, and he ends up in this cave, and he's amazed at this mounds and mounds of gold inside this cave, and he just feeds his greed and his ego. He starts feeding how angry he is at all of his other friends that are on there, and he finds out they're not my friends, and they hate me, and he's just getting worse and worse, and he wakes up, and he finds that he has been transformed and transfigured into a giant, mighty dragon. And he's having a problem because he had put on this bracelet, this gold bracelet on his arm, and now his arm is massive, and it's hurting, and it's painful, and he doesn't like this, and he realizes now I'm going to be no longer allowed to be with my friends, and he starts realizing that how he is not good. And then he ends up encountering the Jesus figure in that book. His name is Aslan. He is a lion. And Aslan says, it's time for you to get rid of your exterior, get rid of your sin, your greed, your arrogance, your anger. And so Eustace starts, scratching at his skin like some reptile. And as he does, he looks down and he sees this mound of scales and flesh. And he's like, oh, I did it. But he looks down in the water and he sees he's really only shed like one layer. And then he starts scratching again. He does it again, gets another one a little bit thicker. And that one hurt a little bit more as he's digging in this. And finally, he realizes there's nothing he can do to shed his nasty exterior. And that's when Aslan says, I will do it for you. And the way it's written is Aslan pulls out his claws and he plunges it deep into that thick, nasty skin. And the character Eustace is like, it hurt so bad that I thought I was going to die. And Aslan is ripping and tearing and pulling apart until finally, all of that is gone. I think that is what is happening in a corporate sense to the Israelite nation as they are going off into captivity. They have rebelled against God. They're no longer following him. We're going to find out there's not just the people are not just responsible. You're going to find out that the leadership is responsible. And then it really hurts because he starts railing against the prophets that have not been speaking the word of God to the people in a proper way. And he says, all of you have to realize that this, in my anger, is to save your life. In my wrath, I need to rip away stuff that is preventing you from even listening to me. And I'll ask a question now and ruminate this on this as when we start. God's punishment for the Israelite nation being carried off into captivity, did that negate God's promise of salvation for those who believe? And what does that mean for us that sometimes bad stuff happens to us, but that does not mean God has abandoned us completely? Nor does that mean he is done with us. So Lamentations chapter 2, you're going to find out this is where God destroys. God is angry. You're going to hear this over and over again. And I have a feeling that the majority of us have, at one time or another, experienced these exact words. We hear this and we go, oh yeah, I know what that's like. And it helps us see that as people of God, you don't have to just put on a smiley face. You don't just have to be happy when you're not. God gives us the freedom and the permission to also get a little angry back. Let's read this. Lamentations chapter 2. I'm going to do the first 10 verses, then there's going to be a change in voice. How the Lord has covered the daughter of Zion with the cloud of his anger. He has hurled down the splendor of Israel from heaven to earth. He has not remembered his footstool in the day of his anger. Without pity, the Lord has swallowed up all the dwellings of Jacob. In his wrath, he has torn down the strongholds of the daughter of Judah. He has brought her kingdom and princes down to the ground in dishonor. In fierce anger, he has cut off every horn, which is symbolic of power, anything powerful of Israel. He has withdrawn his right hand of protection at the approach of the enemy. He has burned in Jacob like a flaming fire that consumes everything around it. Like an enemy, he has strung his bow. His right hand is ready like a phone. He has slain all who were pleasing to the eye. He has poured out his wrath like fire on the tent of the daughter of Zion. The Lord is like an enemy. He has swallowed up Israel. He has swallowed up all her palaces and destroyed her strongholds. He has multiplied mourning and lamentation for the daughter of Judah. He has laid waste his dwelling like a garden. He has destroyed his place of meeting. The Lord has made Zion forget her appointed feasts and her Sabbaths. In his fierce anger, he has spurned both king and priest. The Lord has rejected his altar and abandoned his sanctuary. He has handed over to the enemy the walls of her palaces. They have raised a shout in the house of the Lord as on the day of the appointed feast. The Lord determined to tear down the wall around the daughter of Zion. He stretched out a measuring line, a measuring tape, and did not withhold his anger from destroying. He made ramparts and walls lament. Together they wasted away. Her gates have sunk into the ground. Their bars he has broken and destroyed. Her king and her princes are exiled among the nations. The law is no more, and her prophets no longer find visions from the Lord. The elders of the daughter of Zion sit on the ground in silence. They have sprinkled dust on their heads and put on sackcloth. The young women of Jerusalem have bowed their heads to the ground. All right, well, how do you feel? That's kind of, that kind of fun? It's always a, yeah. One of the challenges that we have in American Christianity is we have a difficulty ascribing to God things like this. When we talk about God giving punishment and using some other things, we talk more about the punishment that should come upon the instruments that God has chosen, but we very rarely ascribe to God like direct causation. We're a little bit more comfortable with the phrase, God has allowed it to happen. But in those 10 verses, was there any mistaking of who is acting against Israel. There's no mistake. You could have counted all the pronouns. He did this. He did this. God did this. Yahweh did this. The Lord did this. He broke them down. He strung his bow. He shot the arrows. He broke the gates down. He broke the bars of protection. He literally destroyed everything. He pulled out a measuring tape to make sure that not one inch of that place did not receive his wrath. There is a time for everything. There's a time to weep. There's a time to laugh. There's a time to live. There's a time to die. And in one of those, it's a hard one to hear. There's a time to build up, and there is a time to tear down. Now, this is one of those things that I do believe that we have a little bit of options as we think about this. I mean, do the head exercise with me, and hopefully this will help. And if you're going through this, I mean, obviously try it yourself, but this is a hard lesson to learn when you're in the midst of it. But when God comes at you with his wrath, there's a couple of responses you can do. One response is to just become bitter and angry, right? That's kind of our default, right? When someone starts getting angry at me, like I do something stupid and my wife gets angry, what's my default response back? Why are you getting angry at me? What was that? Or shut down. Yes, that one's a great one, yeah. And a lot of people, I do this a lot when it comes to, I don't know why this happened, but when there are two people are getting together, one of them is usually the dragon and one is usually the knight, right? And the dragon, you know, there's a fight, and what does the dragon do? Retreat and shut down, right? And then the knight is like, no, foul beast, come back, I shall slay thee. And then the dragon has only one choice, which is, I'm just going to burn you all up, right? And so retreating, being silent, finding ways to maybe turn it around. I'm really good at that one. Finding ways to get out from underneath someone's anger. But what is a better response? Listening. Understanding. Probably the hardest thing to do. How about taking responsibility for your stupidity? That's hard. That's hard to do. I mean, especially for me, because I'm really close to perfection. I got to say things like that. We got to keep it light, because this thing is absolutely depressing. If you don't laugh a couple of times, you're going to be like, I hate this whole thing. Yeah. And there's also another reaction that we can do, and I think this is super helpful. I'm going to be ripping off a different thing, but I think it ties in, that you have an option when it comes to your ego, your sin, your pride. You have the option to try and do it yourself. It says, humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord. So sometimes it's best to just come to God quickly and say, I messed up and I don't know what to do. And that helps, because if you don't have that, then the only other alternative is God's going to have to rip off that nasty, scaly dragon skin of yours, and I guarantee you it's not going to be pretty. So I listen to this and I go, yeah, I think there's been times, I think we've all felt it, where we think God is against us. But I want to make sure and point out one specific phrase that it's easy to like gloss over, but I hope you, and if you need to, maybe you need to underline it. Verse 5. The Lord is like an enemy. What does it, say God is our enemy? No, this is the tough thing. When God has to come at us like an enemy to shake us up, to wake us up, to make us rethink what's going on in our life, sometimes he has to come at us like an enemy. There was a king in the Bible that actually experienced this very thing. And it was a king that was actually involved in all of this. It was this king, and his name was Nebuchadnezzar. He was partially responsible for the siege against Jerusalem in 586, and then was responsible for them being carried off into what was called the Babylonian captivity. So Nebuchadnezzar was the king of Babylon. And at that point, he was like, I can't believe this. I conquered the Jews. Like, I did this. Look how great I am. Look how powerful I am. And God is like, yeah, just to let you in on a secret, it wasn't really you. Like, it was me. I did it. I helped. Like, don't go off on this ego trip. But Nebuchadnezzar kept going and kept going and kept going and kept going until one day, Nebuchadnezzar went crazy. He ended up out in the fields. He used to be a king in a palace, and now he is sleeping outside, and the dew of the grass is covering him. And he starts to hunch over a lot more, and then his hair just kept getting longer and longer, and it kind of almost looked like feathers on his, and his fingernails, his nasty, grody fingernails, all of a sudden started growing out more and more, and he was like a wild beast. And God said, Nebuchadnezzar, I have to do this. But there will come a day. There will come a day when you will acknowledge me as king, as God. And when you do, all will be restored. And guess what happened? It's one of those crazy stories because you would think, you know, a stubborn, strong king is not going to repent, but he does. Which is also what then happens to the Israelite nation. As they're in captivity, it took them 70 years to go, maybe what we should do is just simply acknowledge our sin. And then God will restore us. And that was the promise that was made to all of them. So again, if you are in the middle of a real difficult time, it's hard to do it when you're in the midst of the pain. But if you ever get to the point and the feeling that maybe you think God has abandoned you or God has left you or God is against you or God is like an enemy to you, instead of screaming and yelling back, which you will, instead of shaking your fist into the heavens, which you will, we stop and we say, all right, God, what do I need to learn from this today? God is this instrument. Now, God is doing all of this, and then you get verses 11 through 19. We now get it almost back again to this depression. You see almost these stages of grief that the nation as a whole is going through. You know, they're sad, they end up getting depressed, and now sometimes they're angry. They often did a lot of denial. Here now is this change from God's doing this, to verse 11, my eyes fail from weeping. I mean, that's... Have your eyes ever hurt so much because of the crying that you did? Like you can't even see anymore. You've rubbed them so many times, I can't even see anymore. That's how much I've cried. I am in torment within. My heart is poured out on the ground because my people are destroyed, because children and infants faint in the streets of the city. They say to their mothers, where is bread and wine? As they faint like wounded men in the streets of the city, as their lives ebb away in their mother's arms. What can I say for you? With what can I compare you, O daughter of Jerusalem? To what can I liken you that I may comfort you, O virgin daughter of Zion? Your wound is as deep as the sea. Who can heal you? And now they start doing some reflection. Go ahead. What? Yeah, so that was that's just one of the phrases that Jerusalem is the daughter of Zion. It is the preferred. It's the daughter of the Lord. It's Yeah, it's not actually, there's an interesting thing, but I won't get into the Hebrew on it, but yeah, it's you're the daughter of the Lord. The city was always likened as a female. So this is, if you remember last week, it was all female language, yeah. And so the city always is referred to as the daughter, yeah. And, you know, God's love for the daughter, and again, God's love for the son, so to speak, and daughter, but that's, yeah. It's, as they're weeping, as they're struggling, as they're suffering, now there comes a time when there's this reckoning of what happened. And here's one of the problems. The visions of your prophets were false and worthless. They did not expose your sin to ward off your capacity. The oracles they gave you were false and misleading. Okay, so that doesn't really apply to any of you, I think. That's a passage for me. It's a great reminder. Are there times that I've got to tell you of your vast sinfulness? And who here enjoys it when I do that? Anyone enjoy that, right? Let me tell you, there is a constant. I'm looking forward to Easter, because let me tell you, Easter, we're going to be out of Lamentations, and it's going to be wonderful. And I'm going to tell you that Jesus rose from the dead and forgives you all your sin, and it's going to be the greatest day in history, and you'll all be clapping and happy. But then there's also times that I've got to tell you that it was your sin that put Jesus on the cross. It was your sin that caused him to lose his life. It was your sin that brought about Good Friday. And if you never hear that you are a sinner, have I done you any favors? Nope. Now, again, I joke about it a lot, but I'm serious now. I read stuff like this and I think more about myself than I do about you. That the easy thing that we tend to do is focus on how good we are, how right we are, and we love to talk about our relationship with God, but we hate to talk about the dark side. We hate to talk about the sin. We hate to talk about that monster that is deep inside our soul and is waiting to come out at a moment's notice and often does in our everyday activities. And we don't want to talk about that, because if we talk about that, then we have to talk about God's anger. God's anger at saying, I don't like this about you. I don't like what's happening to you. I don't like the direction you're going. I don't like the hubris that you have. I don't like the pride that is in your heart, and now it is coming out in these massive scales that is just taking over in this knobby skin. And we don't like to talk about that, but we have to. It's one of the foundational principles of Christianity, that the place we start is that we are sinners. And I know we always love to talk about good old Adam and Eve, and it's their fault, and yes, it was, but I always loved how, I think it was my seminary professor who put it this way, that there's Adam and Eve at the crossroads of essentially eternity, and what they are about to do is going to have grand effects, not just for their lives, but literally for all mankind. And it's as if Adam and Eve looked down all of creation and looked at you and looked at me and everyone around and said, what do you think? Should we eat the fruit? And all of us in unison cried out, yes, eat it. That's not far from the truth. That's who we are. And as a pastor, I sometimes need to point out our sin. It's serious. It's not something to be trifled with. But before you start to despair, there's something stronger, better, greater, more powerful than every sin we've committed, and that is God's grace. And what is going to be interesting is how God is going to somehow reconcile his mercy, grace, and love with his anger and his justice. But for now, we're going to keep on going. Verse 15, again, these waves of pain are going over the collective and the lamenter. All who pass your way clap their hands at you. They scoff and shake their heads at the daughter of Jerusalem. Is this the city that was once called the perfection of beauty, the joy of the whole earth? All your enemies open their mouths wide against you. They scoff and gnash their teeth and say, "We have swallowed her up. This is the day we have waited for. We have lived to see it. The Lord has done what he planned. He has fulfilled his word, which he decreed long ago. He has overthrown you without pity. He has let the enemy gloat over you. He has exalted the horn, the strength, the power of your foes." The hearts of the people cry out to the Lord. O wall of the daughter of Zion, let your tears flow like a river day and night. Give yourself no relief, your eyes no rest. Arise, cry out in the night. As the watches of the night begin, pour out your heart like water in the presence of the Lord. Lift up your hands to him for the lives of your children who faint from hunger at the head of every street. This reflection that the lamenter is going through is helping him understand one really important truth, that God is the wounder and also the healer. That God is the destroyer, but also the rebuilder. And the temptation that we have when we are suffering under the wrath of God is to abandon God altogether. But I think you really need to see how, in this thing, what is the lamenter doing every single time? They're crying out back to God. I've mentioned it before, but I'll say it again. It's one of those times when I've gone into periods of grief with other people. Something bad has happened in their life, usually something like a death. And I could hear their anger, I can hear their struggle, and I can hear them questioning and asking, why is God doing this? And maybe they have a more nuanced view, and they say, well, yeah, God's not doing this, but God is allowing this, and God is maybe encouraging what's going on, and this is hard for me. And usually in those types of situations, it's really hard. It's difficult to listen to, but they're still crying out to God. It's only happened, I think, twice in my entire ministry when I've gotten into a situation like that, and there is almost this cold numbness that has come over the people, and they have this quiet acceptance of the fact that there is no such thing as God. They have rejected him altogether. So who do they have to be angry at? I can't be angry at God. God doesn't exist. And when I see that, I get very scared. And that's when I usually have to pull them back and help them to see the fullness of God, that God is not just defined by his wrath and his anger and his justice, but he is also seen in his forgiveness and his grace and his mercy. So if you are angry at God, be angry. If you are so devastated at what God has allowed to happen in your life, weep. Weep till your eyes fail. Pour out your heart day and night to God, because he sees it, he knows it, and he loves you. It ends with these two three final verses I don't like these verses. I was actually tempted to just stop there because, you know, that'd be a perfect place to stop. But again, it's the horror of what has taken place is so bad. You and I really don't contemplate or comprehend what has gone on. Look, O Lord, and consider. They're pleading, God, like, look at us. Look at the pain we're in. Whom have you ever treated like this? Should women eat their offspring? the children they have cared for. Should priest and prophet be killed in the sanctuary of the Lord? That is not a euphemism. It's not a, doesn't mean something else. It literally means that, because that is exactly what happened. That's how bad it had become. Got to the point that they reverted to cannibalism. They actually asked judges to adjudicate, even though they're under siege, judges to adjudicate. We agreed that we would eat their child first and our child first and their child second, so we ate our child, but they're not giving up their child to us to eat. This is beyond bad. It's the last ditch effort of God to wake up a nation so that they would return to him. Verse 21, young and old lie together in the dust of the streets. My young men and maidens have fallen by the sword. You have slain them in the day of your anger. You have slaughtered them without pity. As you summoned to a feast day, so you summoned against me terrors on every side. In the day of the Lord's anger, no one escaped or survived. Those I cared for and reared, my enemy has destroyed. The entire place was destroyed. It got destroyed so badly that the temple, that had a lot of its riches and stuff, they set fire to it. And what ended up happening was the gold that was in there actually got melted. And as it melted, it got into some of the ground stones. So you know what the Romans did as they continued to destroy the place? They wanted the gold. So what did they do? They literally tore down brick by brick everything in the temple so that they could get down to the bottom. So when you looked, there was no temple. They are gone. They're destroyed. There's not even anyone left. They've taken anyone else in captivity and shipped them off to Babylon. It's gone. That's a hard thing to understand. That's a hard thing for us to do. When God destroys, it's painful. But God is also a builder. God is a rebuilder. God's love is always there. And now this is where the challenge becomes. Because God still gets angry, right? Does God still get angry at our sin? Does God still get angry when we do things that are bad? Yeah, God is still a God of justice and anger. And yet, why doesn't he just smite us dead, right? Don't we all deserve that? So what he did was he decided to funnel and channel every ounce, every bit, every scrap of anger. He poured it out on one person, Jesus Christ. And the fact that Jesus, having the heaps and the sins of all the world, and God looking at this world that he loves, he's like, but how can I love it? They do everything wrong. And so Jesus becomes the person that stands in our place, and everything that should have come to us, God with laser precision laid it all on Jesus. So when you hear Jesus say things like, my God, why have you forsaken me? You kind of understand it a little bit more. It's not just the sins of all the people in the past that God heaped onto Jesus. It was your sin and my sin that he heaped onto Jesus. And wave after wave of wrath poured over him. And if you have ever been on the receiving end of God's anger, if you've ever been on the receiving end of God's abandonment, it is horrible. Now imagine that times billions for God to pour his wrath out on Jesus Christ. And when that happened, the wrath of God was satisfied. We hate hearing things like this. We like to just say God forgives our sins, but please don't, again, it's not a cliche, right? When you say God loves you, what does that mean? That means in spite of the fact that you are horrible, nasty, gross, ugly, and disgusting because of the nature of your heart and the sin that you commit, God poured his wrath out on Jesus and poured his love on you. So don't just simply say, God loves me. That means very little. I hope you get the impact of what it means to say, God has forgiven my sin. Which is why we have to look at the cross, which is why we have to look at Good Friday, which is why we have to see Jesus agonizing and dying. We have to see him gasping for breath. We have to see him still pouring out his love on people around him and receiving all the mocking and the shaking of the head and the wagging and the spitting and the crown of thorns and all of that. We see that because that is the wrath of God being poured out on one man for you and for me and the sins of the whole world. If you are in a place where you are hurting because of what God has done or even allowed, may you know that God is a builder after he destroys. And sometimes we need those things in our lives destroyed so that our hearts are fully and completely only for God. And if you are in a place where you're thinking, I'm doing pretty good. I'm feeling pretty strong. I'm feeling pretty great. I'm feeling like I got everything all together. May this be just simply a cautionary tale, just as it was for Nebuchadnezzar. You don't need to be hunched over in a meadow like a beast. Instead, may you humble yourselves and come to God and say, I've messed up. I deserve all the wrath. I deserve hell itself. Thank you, thank you, thank you for Jesus. And may you not have to hurt so badly that you lose in despair and don't have Christ. But may this be something that points you back to Jesus and for his forgiveness.